This is Inside Asia, and I'm Steve Stein. Our question this episode, what does a globalized, digitized, increasingly liberalized China look like? It's a question familiar to our listeners, most particularly for those who've been paying close attention to official Chinese government pronouncements. We're told that reforms are in play, with more to come. Things are opening up, but of course it's a bit more complicated than that. While tidings of rapid privatization and catastrophic growth may delight our mainstream capitalist, Chinese officials are less enamored. A planned economy has been the path to prosperity for more than 35 years in China. But as the country emerges as the world's second largest economy, the stakes have changed. Future growth depends on greater global interconnectedness, and therein lies the rub. Going global means less control, more opening up, greater liberalization, and of course, some element of volatility and even chaos. These are words that make China's Communist Party leaders wince. It's a brave new world, and how China responds to these challenges is the subject of this week's episode. To help us understand this and other questions, my guest is David Hoffman, Senior Vice President and Managing Director of the Conference Board in Asia. Hoffman moves regularly between China, Singapore, and the U.S., sharing his views on past trends and future prospects for the Chinese economy. I spoke to him recently from the offices of the American Chamber of Commerce in Singapore. I've known David for years. Full disclosure, he actually hired me 20 years ago. It was a time when PricewaterhouseCoopers was building a consulting presence in the region, and he thought maybe I could help. We both left consulting years ago, but Hoffman went on to cultivate a view on China through years of research, writing, relationship, and observation. For those Inside Asia listeners who haven't heard of the Conference Board, it has a long-standing and distinguished history. We opened there. I asked Dave to share a bit about the organization and the work he and his colleagues are doing in China.
The Conference Board is now a 101-year-old business think tank and membership association, and we are a genuinely nonpartisan, objective nonprofit. I'm somewhat new to the nonprofit world or the think tank world. I didn't realize how aligned parties are, and that's not to say that aligned parties don't do, some don't do great work, but the Conference Board is very unique in being genuinely independent and nonpartisan. Even though we're funded by business who become members in our program. And I guess the easiest way to describe it is the story of our founding, where it was 1916. World War I was raging. The U.S. wasn't yet part of it. The global economy was tremendously imbalanced. And in the United States, among other things, there was terrible worker unrest. And a group of 10 CEOs got together and said, we need a genuinely independent research group to study these labor issues and inform us with facts, the facts we need to better engage the workforce, the workers, the unions, the regulator in Washington. And the Conference Board was established with that mission in mind, to produce facts on the most difficult sort of business issues of the era, typically those at the intersection of business and society. And our first study then was on the cost of living for the American worker. And in the course of undertaking that work, we developed the consumer price index methodology, you know, now in use by research organizations and governments around the world to measure inflation.
That came out of the Conference Board.
Yes. And the 10 founding members would come to our office and sit around the Conference Board table and listen to the research findings and then discuss how they were dealing with these issues peer-to-peer, privately, behind closed doors.
And that's exactly what happens today.
So the China Center for Economics and Business was similar. A group of our members got together in the early 2000s, and Jim Owens, who was then the CEO of Caterpillar, was a big proponent of it, together with Bert de Grave, who was then the CEO of Beckert Engineering out of Brussels, and several other of our members, and they got together and they said, you know, China is big, material, difficult, challenging. The data are weak. We don't really know.
We need insight.
We need insight. Yeah. The Conference Board should be here to inform our thinking.
And they found you.
That's right. Well, okay. They found me a couple years into the program, and I've been there since now 2008. And I run the conference board in Asia. I'm the senior vice president of the Organization for Asia, and I also lead our China Center for Economics and Business in Beijing.
This is Steve Stein, and you're listening to Inside Asia. This week, my guest is David Hoffman, senior vice president and managing director of the conference board in China. In my conversation, I went on to ask David about the prospects and the plight of Chinese exceptionalism. For decades, the country's communist leaders led the country through phenomenal change, all the while contending that China is fundamentally different, subject to a unique set of guiding economic principles that could be leveraged to ensure its success. I asked David what he thought about this. Are politicians and policymakers in China really all that different from those of any other country? Or is structural change as difficult and unpopular in China as it is everywhere else?
Our thesis is different, and we call it the long soft fall in Chinese growth.
It sounds gentle,
and that's largely due to the acumen of Chinese economic and financial regulators. They're very good at kind of smoothing out what in other places can be quite sudden seizures or crises types of conditions. But the point is that China has not achieved a new normal in terms of a stable growth rate. At the core, China is instead amidst a deep structural downshift, which is actually quite normal. So the four little dragons, Indonesia, Japan, all went through a long investment-led growth phase where the growth started on the back of low-cost factor inputs that made exports competitive, followed by infrastructure investment booms, followed by real estate investment booms, followed by financialization of the economies and the stock markets. You remember Taiwan in the 80s, the booming stock markets, everyone quitting their jobs and going and betting
day
on stocks all day.
Right.
Yeah. China is going through a similar transition.
And the argument is that, you know, why should it be any different from China?
Exactly.
Everyone has to go through it.
Exactly.
It's part of growing up.
Yeah, so the two prevailing thoughts that we contended with in the long soft fall were precisely that, the exceptionalism of the Chinese economy. We said it's not exceptional. It has a number of special characteristics, but it doesn't defy the laws of economic gravity. And secondly, this notion of the infallibility of Chinese leaders.
Oh, beautiful.
You know, think of it for a moment. When you read what most analysts write on China, they'll say, China should be just fine. Beijing knows these problems, and if they attend to this, it'll be just fine. And my question is, well, what if they don't?
Right.
What if reform is actually just as hard as it is anywhere else? So structural reform everywhere is difficult, because it tends to be politically unpopular and socially painful.
And they're trying to do both things. They're trying to ease the minds and ease the concerns of the Chinese citizen at the same time. They do and understand the need to reform, though, right?
Well, they may or they may not. I mean, the point is that, unfortunately, politicians around the world will tend to look at structural reform and they will acknowledge that it's necessary. But for whatever reason, they won't willingly embark on that path because of the political uncertainty it may cause, because of the social disruptions it can cause. And so that age-old idiom around kicking the can is what most do. And China is doing exactly that. And we said, number one, China is not exceptional. It's different in many respects, but it's not exceptional. It too will experience diminishing returns in investment. It too will need to shift to services and consumption. It too will find that shift very difficult. It too will have to pay for the economic costs of development that didn't pay enough attention to environmental protection and so forth. All of these things will exert pressure on growth. And until it happens, until reforms address those drags on productivity, Chinese growth is going to continue to slow down.
So they think they can control the levers of change with a political umbrella. They believe that somehow we're going to kind of maneuver our way, and this is the long soft fall theory. The idea that we can go down, we can land this aircraft gently. It doesn't have to be a crash.
Exactly, and they can land it slowly, and they can land it probably safely, but it comes at great cost. It costs a lot of financial resources to do that. So if you want to, you know, continue goosing the economy with investment, even though the returns on investment are low or negative, you can do that, and it will sustain growth. But it will keep growth going temporarily.
It'll drain the coffers.
It will drain resources, and it will delay the inevitable. And in general, the longer, you know, you delay the inevitable, whether it's in personal life or business life or national economic life, the more painful it becomes.
So the advice is take the medicine, take it now.
That's the way it would normally work. Now, under the previous administration, there was a lot of talk about how painful this will be. If you remember the speeches of Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao, they would talk about the four uns. China's economy is unsustainable, unstable, uncoordinated, unbalanced, that kind of thing. All that talk has now gone away. You know, Li Keqiang, when he first assumed office as premier, which he is today, said that, you know, the reforms would feel so painful that it would feel like slitting our own wrists. So in comes the new government, and the vaunted 13th plenum of the Communist Party in November 2013, and they came up with a list of 60 reform points. And the list is great. It covers everything: state and enterprise reform, environmental restoration, everything.
It's a long list.
Right. And it made many people very excited. But it dawned on us that it was structured in a way that gave us pause for thought. Specifically, those 60 points have been floating around for a long time with, you know, little or no action or progress. So it is a long list, and it's a good list, but it's a list that has been around a long time. Secondly, every single reform statement is paired with an anti-reform statement coupled by a timing conditional. So let me give you an example. Mm-hmm. We will let markets play a decisive role in Chinese economic development.
However,
at the appropriate time.
Oh, I see.
But state-owned enterprises will remain core pillars of the Chinese socialist market economy.
Yeah. So conditional market,
And two polar sides
of
the same issue. Which side will win? It's a schizophrenia where, you know, are we going to let markets play a role, or are we going to have state-owned enterprises play the lead role?
Is that their out? Is that the way of basically playing it? Let's see how it goes. And we can always say from the, you know, we can look back to 2013 and say, well, we told you it would be with conditions.
Well, you know, in my view, it sort of represents the two sides of the Chinese polity. There is a group that favors a more statist model, more central planning, more guided, you know, state-administered economic development, and there is a group that prefers more market as a key growth driver and reform agent. I wouldn't say that anyone really that I've ever met prefers free markets, and maybe there's something to that, looking at kind of the chaos that free markets have had, you know.
And democracies.
Exactly. Yeah. So the messiness of it all. But the third plenum had a couple other important points. One was this notion that reform should be done by comprehensive planning and top-level design. Mm. And secondly, the establishment of two leading small groups, one on comprehensively deepening reform and one on national security, led by President Xi himself.
Consolidated in power.
And so far, I think now I can't remember if there are 10 or 11 or even 12 of such groups. But these leading small groups have basically taken top policy design and administration out of the civil government. So there are many who think that the party and government in China are the same. They're not. The government is the state council and its attendant ministries led by the office of the premier. And they're the ones who have typically undertaken economic policy. The party's always been there. It sets the long-term ideological objectives, et cetera. And it's always been of paramount power, if you will. But they've left government process to the technocrats, to the bureaucrats.
And that's changed.
That's changed.
Yes. And this is what's so interesting about what's going on. So, you know, that wonderful, you know, Deng Xiaoping said in the late 1970s, you know, we will develop capitalism with Chinese characteristics.
Yes.
And that was the one, you know, that kind of started the whole ball rolling. That almost set the terms, the framework for how China was going to evolve and develop. And if one thing has been consistent over time, it's that notion.
Yeah.
That notion that there is this interplay, albeit invisible to the rest of the world in terms of how policy is being carried out. But now it does feel like the party is actually taking a stronger control. Is that because they're concerned about this soft landing?
I think they were concerned about the ineffectiveness of the government in terms of, the lack of discipline in policy and process and other things.
Discipline's a big word. Now.
Discipline's a big word. It's the biggest word. And so you might think
what is
of
it
what,
in Chinese?
Gosh, you got
put you
me.
On the corner.
Yeah.
Don't worry about it.
Yeah. But discipline. I was thinking of a thought there. I mean, discipline in the Leninist sense is what we're really seeing transpire. But you mentioned Deng Xiaoping, and I think what's important to recognize is that Deng Xiaoping's reform and opening up, we think of him today as a paramount leader who had no opponents
right.
at the time, but actually he had very significant rivals. And in 1982, one of his chief rivals, Chen Yun, one of the Ba Lao, the eight immortals of the Chinese Revolution,
The birdcage analogy.
Right. Yeah. He wrote an essay called the Birdcage Economy, the Niaolong Jingji. And the concept is quite simple. The market is a beautiful songbird that can make beautiful music, but it must always be confined within the steel cage of the state, lest it escape and wreak chaos. And chaos is a concept that, Chinese, the government and the party and even most of the people fear greatly.
Dynasties rise and fall on the back of chaos
and
change, yeah.
So it dawns on us that the birdcage has always been there, Steve. And this is something that, has only really dawned on me after 32 years of working and thinking about China. But the foreign investor experience in China has always been defined as temporary, transitional, and contained.
Yeah, from the very beginning.
From the very beginning. Yeah. So let me give you an example. Yeah. You've got a foreign auto brand. They sign a JV. It's for 20 years. It's for two models. It has production quota. And of course, the foreign investor thinks, don't worry, we'll get in there, we'll invest, we'll win-win, our partner will love us, we'll make loads of money, and we'll be allowed to do whatever we want. Guess what?
They held them to
it's held.
This is Inside Asia. My guest is David Hoffman, lead executive for the Conference Board in Asia. More in a moment.
Inside Asia is produced in partnership with 1880, a members club in Robertson Quay, in the heart of downtown Singapore. Born out of the idea that conversations can and will make the world a better place, 1880 offers a space in which diverse minds gather and great ideas bloom. For more information or to inquire about membership, visit www.1880.com.sg.
This is Steve Stein, and you're listening to Inside Asia. I'm speaking with David Hoffman, Senior Vice President of the Conference Board in Asia and longtime China watcher. Let's get back to our conversation.
So what my job is really to try to piece together all of these big things in a puzzle. It's a little bit like a Da Vinci Code.
Yeah.
But
you look a little like Dan Brown, by the way.
But it was like 2000, when was it? 2012, where Apple got hammered for a non-standard warranty process in China. And basically, anywhere in the world, if your iPhone breaks, you bring it back to point of sale, they give you a new one. Well, in China, they didn't because they couldn't discern the fake product from the real product. They would send it back to factory. If it was real, they'd give a new one to the user. If not, they'd return the old one. And then a series of investigations and crackdowns unrolled from there.
The Chinese authorities.
From the Chinese authorities.
Because they didn't like that.
Well,
they didn't,
Fonterra had a tainted milk product problem in Sri Lanka. They got hammered. The whole dairy industry got hammered in China. Foreign dairy, infant formula, where 10 foreign infant formula baby powder companies were fined for anti-competitive pricing. It moved on to medical pharma first, with GSK being the poster child for undertaking corrupt practices and drug promotion in China. Moved on to auto parts, medical devices, eventually autos for pricing controls. And finally, to ICT.
So these are smoke screens or devices.
Well, I think if you look at all of those sectors, they have some things in common. Firstly, they are consumer-facing sectors where the real growth is. Second, they are almost all dominated by foreign investors in aggregate. And so we think it's the birdcage coming down.
Right.
Here's where the growth is.
Yeah.
Now, the elites in China prior to that had been concentrating on the industrial sector. It was booming, it was growth, there was huge investment, all this neat stuff. Now that is diminishing because there's tremendous overcapacity and most of the companies, you know, are not profitable. Here's where the growth is, and guess what? Foreigners have a strong position in those markets.
Oh, that's so interesting.
So let's claw it back, put them back in the birdcage, and this gets to your point about digitalization. Let's make sure that in these, you know, extremely important e-commerce internet choke points, we have our monopolies fully installed so that we control, you know, the future of digital in China.
And that there, and then comes in the unlevel playing field where these different methods are used to contain, control, to cage, and then in the meantime letting loose the powers of the domestic player.
Well, it's kind of good and bad. So if you install a monopoly, and this is a contentious point, like an Alibaba in commerce, or you support the installation of that monopoly, it gives you the market more order. It allows for elite extraction. It allows for hypervaluation on that company because, you know, the monopoly profits are going to be exceptional, or at least the potential for them. But what it really does that's nefarious, and this goes back to the productivity problem, is as soon as you begin to pick winners, that means that the genuinely private firms that would compete on the basis of innovation and product merit are crushed. And that creates a productivity problem. And that is China's biggest problem today.
But David, aren't they borrowing a page from US economic history? I mean, they were the robber barons. We got behind, you know, organizations like this. We allowed monopolies to thrive for years.
Yes.
And it served the US well in terms of domestic and global expansion. They're just doing what we did. Is there really any, I know the world is different and e-commerce and digitalization makes this a little more difficult to control, which may be where the tension's coming. But they're not doing anything illegal necessarily.
No, it's not illegal. You know, and there are merits even to a planned and engineered growth and stability model.
Right.
It's more stable.
Yeah.
So, you know, you might say if you look at the US today and the internet environment with fake news and fraud and so on and so forth, China has that more under control. You might say, if you were cynical, that they have only one source of fake news, whereas we have many and we can't tell one from another.
Right.
At least in China, you know one from the
different
other.
Different shades of gray.
Yeah, different shades of gray. But, you know, whether or not it resolves, you know, so I want to say, because I think you raise a very good point, what I'm talking about here is not to level criticism at China. So when we talk about China openly and candidly, and we look at what's really happening there, and we convey to our members what we deem to be reality, there's always there can be pushback to say, well, the US did the same thing, or Europe did the same thing. That is all true, but it doesn't matter, you know, because, well, two wrongs don't make a right, but also it's not the nature of our argument. We're trying to assist foreign investors be more successful in China. And the criticisms that China might level at the US or elsewhere for being hypocritical are fully warranted. But that's not the point. So I want listeners to understand that I'm not criticizing China per se. I'm just trying to trying to say what we think is really going on there, because we think if you're gonna succeed in business there, you have to accept the realities that you're confronting and not believe, well, okay, I'm gonna ignore what is clear and present in my observation.
Yeah, fair enough. But there is a difference now. I mean, we're talking about, you know, in the past, they were capital-intensive, heavy industry type of growth. Yeah. We're talking about the world of internet, the world of e-commerce, and completely different economic paradigm coming to play. That's much harder to control. And there's all kinds of trade and tax and revenue and regulatory issues that surround that. And so to try to put the birdcage around that, or to develop monopolies in that space, that's going to pose some interesting new challenges, right?
Well, it is. I mean, in some ways, though, it's easier to control because its conduit is the telecom network. It's totally state-controlled. Its conduit are data resources, which the state can totally control. In the government's new national security framework, it lists the 11 areas that are considered scope for national security, and you'd be hard-pressed to find anything that doesn't fall in to one of those buckets. Maybe sports is not included. Yeah. There's one of culture.
Right.
So what this demands, you know, if you are going to manage the economy and engineer growth and stability and manage the digital economy, again, to engineer stability and growth and assure that, you know, no bird escapes that cage that could, you know, wreak havoc, you necessarily have to become more coercive.
David, let's talk about this thing called China Inc.
Yeah.
Right? Very interesting, where it's the interplay between state-sanctioned support and private enterprise companies coming to the fore, moving and marching out into the world with almost that kind of combined strategy, which quite unique in the world today, right?
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that, and then also let's talk about the BATS, the backbone, if you will, to the new consumer internet economy in China, and the red capital that's flowing in to support it. Can you run us through that?
I mean, that's a lot all in one, but... And
do that in 2 minutes.
Yeah, well, in 2 minutes, but you know, it all kind of... Let's talk first about something that I think is really important as a foundation, and that is the notion of a private company.
Mm.
So, you know, would you consider any one of the BATS to be truly private?
Not truly.
Yeah.
And that's what we'll get at.
Yeah.
Right.
So, or any of these other companies.
Yeah.
So,
but they were allowed in their early years to thrive.
I think in the early years, they were arguably genuinely private.
And we're talking about three primarily. BAT represents Baidu, Alibaba, and Tencent.
Yeah, and I mean, but just on the private sector in general.
Yeah, please.
It has transpired that regulators and government officials in China have, through their offices, learned how businesses thrive and make money. And I think it's safe to say they have learned that it can be very lucrative to have footholds in those kinds of businesses, and particularly if regulatory leeways can be bestowed on them and they can grow and scale and even enjoy supernormal profits.
Favoritism.
Well, you could say it that way. And so those that would cite a very optimistic view for China's economic development give great credence and hope to the private sector. And don't get me wrong, China could be and can be an incredibly innovative private sector. It has three of the four forces in Michael Porter's Five Forces model, hands down. The one it doesn't have is that little box up to the left, institutional support. That's where China gets a big red X. And you know, the clearest manifestation of that is, you know, deficient intellectual property protection. But essentially, companies that grow and scale in the domestic market through the process of regulatory engagement eventually become unprivate. They're still called private companies. We call them PUIs.
What perfect name.
Yeah.
And when does it cross that line? Based on size or reach or influence?
It's so hard to know that. And you know, again, this is a concept that, you know, data isn't available to confirm, really. But you know, some very good journalists undertake work on these large enterprises and find that there's all sorts of linkages to power and so forth. But PUIs
mean... The monopolies are the PUIs.
Well, they're either monopolies or oligopolies or duopolies or whatever.
Private entities.
But they're grown. So PUI means P-O-O-E, private obscurely owned enterprises. And these are the companies that dominate the domestic market. And they're anywhere from huge, the BATS and other companies, or, you know, not so large, but large on a city level or large on a provincial level. So take, for example, the distribution and logistics business, or let's take pharma. Pharma distribution. So in the United States, for example, you've got the big players like Cardinal Health and others, three big players that distribute the majority of drugs and medical devices in the United States, and probably another dozen specialty firms. In China, you've got upwards of, I think, 14,000 or 12,000 or 14,000 Why? Because every hospital, maybe every department within a hospital, will have started its own distribution business together with, you know, powerful stakeholders that could secure that turf. And they are the designated distributors in and out of that hospital.
And protected entirely.
Protected entirely, yeah. which undermines efficiency, which increases cost, which undermines regulatory supervision. That's why you have problems with, you know, fake stuff, and because it's, you know, it's much easier to sort of manage 20 big players than it is 12,000, and it leads to tremendous inefficiency. This goes back again to the productivity problem. So this lack of private, and this is what makes reform so hard. So from the vaunted heights of Beijing, the ruling group may be looking and say, we really got to solve that problem. But imagine the resistance you are going to face going from 14,000 down to 20.
Right. And that's the instability you referred to before. You can't undo and relieve yourself of the support that you would otherwise garner by ensuring that that people can continue to conduct businesses as they see fit.
This is why we thought that the view that other analysts had that said, you know, China is an autocratic governance system, that it can go boldly where democracies can't, that it can push through reforms where democracies fail, and it can move quickly, were ill-founded. Because imagine the vested interests involved just in improving the efficiency of the pharmaceutical distribution business in China. I mean, imagine.
Great example.
It's not easy.
Now, excellent example. So now we're talking about the low, slow burn, the kind of the inefficiencies and the lack of productivity gains. And in a world where productivity pretty much is the difference between being profitable and unprofitable, this is the problem.
And the longer productivity problems persist, the more you accumulate the symptoms of them, the results of them. So accumulating debt, accumulating capacity, diminishing efficiency, and so forth. And so at some point, the pain needs to be taken. And the only question is who will take it? Will the sovereign assume the debt? Will the workers be laid off and workers basically assume the debt? Will households bear the cost in terms of higher taxes? Will the banks bear the cost in terms of loan write-offs? You know, these are the decisions facing China today. And the great hope, and again, this links back to the bats, and, you know, sorry if this sounds a little convoluted, but the great hope is that China can grow a way out of this problem.
Right.
So we think that the ruling group, you know, talked about using markets as the driving factor, but what it discovered was that path was risky. So if we let markets consolidate capacity and digest debt, we're going to have bankrupt companies, we're going to have laid off workers, we might have social unrest, it might lead to political instability. That doesn't sound very good. What if it is true that we can actually undertake investment-led growth, and we just did it badly because the party was corrupt and undisciplined?
Right.
So all we need to do is fix the party and then undertake investment via comprehensive planning and top level design, what I said before, and we can do it just fine. It's not that it couldn't be done right or that markets work better. It's that we did it badly because we were corrupt and undisciplined.
Interesting. So this would be the self-reform, the self-review that they're taking right now internally, which we would never see in the public limelight.
Well, exactly.
Right?
So, I mean, again, I don't think anyone really knows what the top leaders think in China. In my view, this approach would make perfect sense. If you're looking at this situation that you've inherited and you're Xi Jinping and his team, and you say, you know, we could undertake the market path, but there's, you know, almost certainly to be things we can't understand and unintended consequences we can't predict and uncertainty, and it may be socially destabilizing, it may be politically destabilizing, but we can undertake Belt and Road and the four megacities and the Shong'an district and all of these things, and we can do it better, and because we're more disciplined. And you can see with some of the PUIs like Anbang and Fosun and Wanda and others now being clipped,
yeah,
right?
They right.
recently, again, discipline, have it be disciplined.
This is Inside Asia. My guest is David Hoffman, Singapore-based head of the Conference Board in Asia and managing partner of the group's China Center. The conclusion to our conversation in just a moment.
Inside Asia is produced in partnership with 1880, a members club in Robertson Quay in the heart of downtown Singapore. Born out of the idea that conversations can and will make the world a better place, 1880 offers a space in which diverse minds gather and great ideas bloom. For more information or to inquire about membership, visit www.1880.com.sg.
I'm Steve Stein, and you're listening to Inside Asia. My guest is David Hoffman, and we've been talking about the recent shifts in the Chinese economy and how it challenges the so-called birdcage analogy made popular by the Chinese communist stalwart Chen Yun. David paraphrases Chen's 1982 essay, saying that, quote, "The market is a beautiful songbird that can make beautiful music, but it must always be confined within the steel cage of the state, lest it escape and reap chaos." Chaos is a theme that runs throughout Chinese history. From the dynastic to the modern era, faced with chaos and uncertainty, the Chinese have tended toward control and discipline. Proclamations, directives, and guiding principles are China's way of letting everyone know the thresholds of conduct. Defy those thresholds, and there are consequences. For thousands of years, China saw itself as the center of all things. It, in fact, referred to itself as the Middle Kingdom, and that in turn shaped the psychology of the people and its culture. For centuries, it was actually forbidden to travel beyond dynastic boundaries. In effect, China was formed by adhering to isolationist principles, remaining self-serving, and resisting the temptation to expand either geographically or economically. All of this changed in the early 1980s, when Deng Xiaoping cast off the shackles of the old world order and urged his countrymen to go forth and prosper. Nearly 40 years on, and China's economic status speaks for itself. Isolationism is no longer an option. It's not even a reality. The question for China's leadership now is how to maintain control as global economic dependency accelerates. Does the plan take into consideration the sort of grassroots innovation which de facto requires global access and engagement? Can its currency withstand the pressures brought to bear as it becomes a global power? And how long can the country resist pressure from its trading partners to reciprocate and lower trade barriers? By virtue of its growing economic prowess, its unique blend of central planning and free enterprise, what's the likelihood of China ring-fencing its market in defiance of the prevailing laws of economics? Will China unveil and open up? Maybe the choice is no longer theirs to make. Perhaps we've passed the tipping point, leaving this aspirational country of 1.4 billion people with no choice but to engage, and in so doing, throwing aside the long-held notion that China is different, that the economy can be controlled, that innovation is somehow planned versus spontaneous.
They have no choice but to try to take a controlled, top-down approach, whether it succeeds or not. If they let loose the kind of elements of free enterprise and true private organizations, it'll run rampant, and that will undermine then the control capabilities that they hold so dear.
It will undermine the party's control.
Which is, at the end of the day, China.
Well, you know, it is the way China works now. But I think a meme that is very easy to visualize, you know, for your listeners is this notion of masters versus markets. Hmm. You've got the masters on one side, the top party leaders, and they're very smart and very capable, versus markets, which are messy and unpredictable and difficult. And China has opened itself little by little over time to markets in the financial sector, in the consumer space, and other things. Chinese consumers like Nike, they like Adidas, they like Mercedes-Benz. And so, you know, you now have a situation where, to your point about RMB, you know, they made it a little bit too open, and there was a lot of volatility in the exchange rate, and now they are closing the capital account to prevent that volatility. You know, and this clash of masters versus markets is what will decide the future of China. Will the masters win? Will the markets win? And that's where we are today.
That's brilliant. I know, big question, but how do you see this playing out? And what would be some of the key confounding moments for them in ensuring the delivery of this plan?
Well, you know, this is an interesting and difficult thing to talk about, because it is inherently unpredictable. But since reform began in 1978, China has gone through periods where the conservatives controlled the seats of power and periods where the technocrats, the more market-oriented faction, if you will, controlled the economic controlled power. And the pendulum has tended to swing back and forth. Victor Schur at UC San Diego wrote a fantastic book on this called Factions and Finance in China, 2009. So that pendulum tends to swing. So you will have, you know, a pretty conservative leader, Jiang Zemin and his team, kind of focusing on the three represents and this and that. Eventually, the economy gets a bit wobbly and it hands off to Zhu Rongji, again, a technocrat, one more in favor of markets and so forth. And we think it stands to reason that that pendulum will swing again. And we also think it stands to reason that the Chinese leaders, at the end of the day, when they see that trying to master these forces and engineer growth and development does not work or is not working, and that they really need to resort to markets, more open markets. Now, you could argue a whole gamut of points of view here about how much markets should be free and or not. But we think they'll respond pragmatically at the end of the day. Chinese leaders tend to respond pragmatically, eventually.
You know what it reminds me of as you describe this? The Fed, you know, monetary policy. How do you use it to control markets, to manage interest rates, yeah, to kind of bring things back into a means of order? It's not that the theory is wrong. It's that it's really never been tested at this level before. And of course, it is politics at the end of the day,
well,
and you've got lots of vested interests.
That's the interesting thing. It's not politics. The Fed is an independent institution.
Speaking about China.
So the problem in China,
yes,
the problem, yeah, is that there are no independent institutions.
That's the issue.
So the party is the only institution.
That's what I mean.
But there are great institutional capabilities there. So in the 2000s, when the World Bank was active in setting up, for example, the Ying Jianhui, the CBRC, the China Banking Regulatory Commission, the Central Bank, and other institutions, China actually set up these offices, staffed them with good people. So, you know, the equivalent of the Fed, with the People's Bank and Zhou Xiaochuan, very capable, great people. And basically, the global thought leaders from banking and finance and everywhere else are walking through their door every day, talking to them about how to best manage these things. These are really capable people. But today they have no power. So what they'll do is they'll write a report on wealth management products and the problems with off-balance sheet lending in China. They'll submit that report to the Central Party Committee for Finance Sector Supervision and Discipline. And the decision is taken there. So compare it to Singapore, or where we are today, where, you know, in terms of governance structure and sort of state pillars in the economy, we have it here too with the big, you know, state firms. But the demarcations between, you know, what is state and what is commercial, what is private, are very clear, very transparent. And the institutions that safeguard those demarcations are very competent and capable and enabled and independent. And that's a big difference. So the good news is that China has facilities. So they have the CBRC, and it's capable. So if they decided tomorrow, we're going to enable the CBRC to deal with the bad loan problem independently, it could happen. They could turn it on,
yeah,
and they could,
yeah,
just go because they're ready.
Yeah.
Boards too. If you want to really get to state-owned enterprise reform, enable boards, period. So again, China has gone a long way on institutional development. Almost all state-owned enterprises, probably without exception, all of them have really well-resourced, capable boards. Staffed with really strong, capable, independent directors, some of whom I know and who have told me that the board engagement they have with the SOE companies that they represent is deeper and better and more meaningful, more immersive than any global board they sit on, with one key exception. They have no vote. That is the institutional mechanism.
That's fascinating. That really is.
So,
yeah.
You know,
so there it is. So that is good news, actually.
They're half
pregnant. Right.
Yeah.
I didn't think that was possible. Apparently it is. David, this is a fantastic conversation. Thank you so much. You've set, I think in many ways, the beginning of other conversations. I hope you'll come back and talk to us.
Sure thing.
There are some other areas that I'd like to touch on, but you've extended yourself, and I just want to say thank you so much.
My pleasure, Steve.
Thanks.
That was David Hoffman, Senior Vice President of the Conference Board in Asia and Managing Director of the group's China Center. That brings us to the end of another episode of Inside Asia. Thanks for listening, and thanks also for all the amazing feedback and encouragement we've been getting. We're pleased that so many of you are enjoying the show and becoming regular listeners. Help us out by taking a second and leaving a review or a comment on iTunes. Those reviews, well, they make a big difference. We're at the end of another show, and it's time to tie things up with a bungkus, which in Indonesian parlance stands for a quick-wrapped takeaway meal. It's what we try to do to sum up our discussions and leave you with some additional food for thought. Where to begin? The evolution of the Chinese economy is no light matter. Next month, China's ruling Communist Party meets for the 19th National Congress. In the world of planned economies, this is a big deal. It sets the economic, political, and social agenda for the next 5 years. It is, if you will, the reinforcement of the proverbial birdcage. In one regard, the birdcage built by China is quite a masterpiece. Larger, more ornate, filled with small chambers, golden perches, and even a retractable bottom for easy cleaning. The steel bars of the cage are built wider than before. It gives the impression of more freedom, but the songbird within has grown fat. He's also learned a few new tunes. But the state, so consumed with the building of the cage, has stopped listening. The bird's song falls on deaf ears. The Bird Academy, yes, there is such a thing, tells us that birds sing to defend and impress, but the ultimate goal is to attract. Through the bars, the caged songbird of China sees the world. His song is filled with hope and aspiration. He hears the call of the other birds and adjusts his own tune in response. It's a new melody, filled with possibility yet tinged with regret. This bird is fed with the seeds of innovation and prosperity, and on the face of it, it seems content. But here's the hitch. Like all songbirds, he calls out not to hear the sound of his own voice, but to attract the attention of others, those in flight, free birds. Powerful image, right? The American poet Maya Angelou said it best when she wrote, "The caged bird sings with a fearful trill of things unknown but longed for still." In penning these lines, it's unlikely that Angelou was thinking of Chen Yun and his musings on a controlled economy for the Middle Kingdom. You might say, however, that she knew a few things about songbirds. Can China's officials say as much? Until next time, this is Steve Stein saying, "Come in from the outside on Inside Asia." Thanks for listening.
Inside Asia is produced in partnership with 1880, a members club in Robertson Quay, in the heart of downtown Singapore. Born out of the idea that conversations can and will make the world a better place, 1880 offers a space in which diverse minds gather and great ideas bloom. For more information or to inquire about membership, visit www.1880.com.sg.